Business success usually comes to those who are too busy to be looking for it. Join RVK for the award-winning RV on Business Show every Tuesday at 12 midday. It's not about thinking out of the box. There is no box. Only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome to 101.9 High FM. It's just gone 9 minutes past 12. Thank you so much for joining me as usual. And thank you so much for all the comments and all the messages that we get sent from all our listeners during the week. Today, I'm going to tackle two of the questions or more two of the quandaries that people are having out there. And the one is not so much a financial planning or a business issue and coming out with a solution. It's more a social issue that is related to financial planning. And that's got to do with having a very bad or poor experience with an existing financial planner. Where do you go from there? And the first thing that I want to say is that some of the comments that I've got are quite concerning. Comments like, well, I will never take advice from anybody again. They are all a bunch of sharks. They're just out there for the commission. I hear those comments, and maybe there are people out there like that. But I think I can say with a strong sense of certainty that there are fewer and fewer people out there operating like that for two main reasons. Number one, the legislation and the way the industry is regulated is so much more involved than it ever was before. And number two, and maybe more importantly, is that you as the client have access to so much information. You can double, triple check anything that you've been told so easily if you want to, that it would be almost suicidal for a person to give you advice that's not really in your best interests. So those comments, I can appreciate them being made because you've obviously been really badly hurt. You either lost money, you've watched a loved one lose money. But one needs to stand back and look at the scenario and understand what happened and why it happened, and then do things to correct it. So let's go through one or two scenarios, going back to a younger person who's starting out, who's looking for someone to help them, someone to guide them, someone to advise them, and they go and see somebody that's recommended. And you sit down with the person and you just feel like you are totally disconnected to what this person's talking about. You're not from the same milieu. You're maybe not from the same community. You don't resonate, doesn't resonate what he's talking about with you. He clearly doesn't understand, or she doesn't understand, your challenges as a young couple, maybe with things like private school and expensive medical aid and a different style of living. What you need to do then is turn around at the end of that first meeting and say, thank you very much. And either say up front, we just feel that this is not for us and this relationship is going to go nowhere. I'm sure that a financial planner worth his or her salt won't let you just work out, but we'll walk out. But we'll try to grow the relationship. But you are in the driving seat. And you need to turn around and say, thank you, but this is not for us. Don't have to give reasons. And if you want to give reasons and just say, we don't feel that we are getting the advice that is appropriate for our stage of life and for our way of living, and move on. And speak to your friends next time you get together on the weekend. Speak to people in the offices. You just need to understand what's going on with your community, who they're using, and go and use people like that. I know when I was a young person, just married, I think we were having our first child, there was a really, really good young financial planner that tried to work with us. He's done incredibly well. The company has done incredibly well, but I just didn't gel. There was something about him that made me uncomfortable. There was a little bit of a pushiness, a little bit of an aggressive way of doing things, which didn't suit me at the time. That particular day, I was under a lot of pressure to be somewhere, and there was lots of stories being told about why and how things should be done. And I just felt that my best interests were not at heart. And I stopped working with that person, and to this day, I think he's a bit upset with me. But that was the thing that I had to do. And then I sat down and started doing myself things myself. And this was about 5 years before I joined the industry and understanding how things work. So that's really, really important to sit down and to work with somebody. Again, maybe on a very personal note, my late father recommended somebody for me to go and see. And that person handled my investments until he passed away many, many years later. In fact, I worked with his son-in-law, who became a colleague of mine at Sage Life and then at Momentum. But I worked with this guy for many, many years. He was there, he was available, he was knowledgeable, and we really felt supported by him. So the fact that you've had a bad experience just means that you've eliminated somebody that you don't want to work with. It's the same as a mechanic, it's the same as a doctor, it's the same as a lawyer. It's the same as someone who comes to, I don't know, mow your grass in your garden. Great guy, wonderful personality, but the grass has got bald patches, cut the cable twice. Not the guy you want to have cutting your grass. Find someone else. That doesn't mean you should never cut your grass again. I know it's an exaggerated experience, but one needs to find somebody that they're comfortable with. The next thing that I got in the same email is this constant referral and reference, sorry, to the lack of feedback, the lack of getting information from the financial advisor. And here I want to break it down into two categories. The first thing is I don't hear from my financial advisor. Unless he wants something from me or she wants something from me, I don't hear from that person. My answer to that is that this is a partnership. You need to be proactive also. If you hear there's a new product out, if you just want an update, if you want a schedule, you want a meeting, pick up the phone. And that's where I get to point two. If you find that when you contact them, there is no feedback, not from them, not from someone in their office, not from the PA, give it 24 hours. If you still haven't heard, try another mode of communication. Today, telephones don't really work. WhatsApp, email. If you don't get a response, you've got a problem. Today, the majority of financial planners worth their salt have infrastructure in place where these type of communication issues are dealt with very, very efficiently. Simply because people have become used to instant gratification, immediate answers. And the moment you don't get back to somebody within the morning, it's seen as neglect, which, quite honestly, in my point of view, is nonsense. You know, people are busy, people have meetings back to back, and maybe at the end of the day, they'll sit down and they get to the message. But if you send a WhatsApp, "Hi, so and so, please, when you give me a call when you get a chance," that simply means when you get a chance. But if you say, "Hi, I'm sitting in the bank, I need to know what my life cover is. Please, can you get someone to call me?" All of a sudden, it takes on a whole different meaning. And there's a good chance someone will be in touch with you. So be in touch. You have to push the relationship from time to time. And you need to make sure that you're communicating in a way where you get feedback on what you need. And unfortunately, that is a very big part of my practice, is picking up a lot of that slack where financial advisors are not getting back to people. And sometimes it really has to do with the fact that there's nothing to report. And what I mean by that is, for example, you've retired and you're moving your money from your pension fund, your provident fund, your retirement annuities, your preservation funds. And the person has told you it's going to take 6 weeks to 3 months. There's four different companies we're dealing with. Company A and B are great. Company B and C are a nightmare. And they have these SLAs, service level agreement times, that they stick to. And if we push them, they put our stuff at the bottom of the pile, so to speak. Then you need to just appreciate that there's nothing much more that they can do. They're already working against the current, so to speak, with the feedback that they're getting from those companies. So it's just about that communication. But let's take a quick break. Let's run to the shops. We'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
So we are getting back to the topic about having had poor service or non-existent service from your financial planner. What do you do now? The next thing I would like to mention is that if you turn around and say, I cannot get my information out of my financial planner, you are stuck in the dark ages. Because these days, you should have all your financial information on an application, on an email, somewhere easy accessible and available. Besides that, you should have a file in your house where there's a printout on the shelf. It's called an in-case file or a what-if file or whatever else you want to call it, that if God forbid something happens to you, you can open it up. There's a name of the person in charge. All the policies are there. The values are there. They might be you're outdated. That's not serious. You've got a policy name. You've got a company name. You've got a policy number. And now you can start the process. Give it to the executor and go from there. But you should be able to get absolutely everything on your app. And I'm seeing this more and more and more, where we send statements to clients. And before, we would get a feedback after we've sent a statement. Today, we don't get feedback. And when you speak to the client and you say, like, are you seeing what we're sending you? They say, yeah, we see it, but I check it on my app every so often. So I see what's going on. When you get to a client review and you sit to the client and you say, right, this is the return you have, within seconds, you can tell whether the client's happy or not, because they've been following the investment over a period of time. And that's where you need to get to. Just like a bank app, which was maybe daunting in the beginning, is now an integral part of your life, so too is your app for the insurance company that you are with. I'm not a fay with other companies besides Discovery, but I'm almost certain that every company has an app that you can download and get easy access to all your information. So the most important thing is that you have it, you have access to it. The other thing that's come up is this idea of multiple financial planners having access to my information. So the email read something along the lines is that I have my life insurance policies with one company, my short-term with another company, my retirement policies, one at work through a third party, and then I have a private one. And everyone keeps checking the other policies. So just to unpack that for the listeners as to what's happening over there, financial planners use a piece of software. It's called Astute. And Astute allows you to go in and download a client's information and get up-to-date information. Prior, you need to one would get a consent from a client to do that, and it'll be vetted for a period of 6 months, a year, or whatever it was at the time. These days, it's basically a one-use document. It does have a time frame on it, but it's regarded as a once-use. You get it from the client, you do the download, you ask for the information, and then you have used that document has served its purpose. Should you want to get more information, you need to request it again. So what that really does, it prevents people from going and checking your stuff a year after you've last spoken to them, a year after you've had any communication, and all of a sudden, someone who's maybe become a little bit estranged is accessing your information. So that is really done to protect the client, to protect the investor, to protect the life insured, so that the information is really where it needs to be. Another thing that has really come up, and again, this is an aside, it did come up in an email during the week, is that clients are really, really, really angry about the password protection that is on every single document that you now receive. I got a comment something like, it is absolutely ridiculous to have to put in a password on my cell phone in such small letters that I can barely see what I'm doing while I'm sitting at a traffic light. Let's just go a step back. As frustrating as it is, sir, it's incredible that you can get documentation on your cell phone that you can just pull over, and have a look at if you want to. Why is the password protection there? The password protection is very simply that we don't send your document to somebody else by mistake. And I can hear you screaming, but how the hell would you send my document to someone else by mistake? Anybody who sat on email for any period of time, sending out huge amounts or ongoing communication, can see, realizes how simple it is to type in AVK, and then instead of hitting enter or moving the cursor with your mouse down, you just keep typing and you say hi, and next thing, Harold comes up and it chooses the last Harold email that you've used. And now you send the document off, and Harold happens to be, I don't know, your boss, your ex, somebody that you would freak out if they saw your information, and it's been sent without a password. Harold would never know how to open that document. So having just sent that is already a breach. But Harold being able to open it is something that is punishable, to put it bluntly. And that's why we are so careful with making sure that everything is password protected. Up until recently, internal documents didn't need to be. So, Sophie, if I'm looking at your stuff and I'm sending it to my secretary, and then she's sending it to another department, that didn't need to be password protected. So many companies have gone to the step now where they are password protecting that, just that there's no scenario where a document isn't password protected. So it is, it's just you've got to remember your ID number or your date of birth, and 99% of the time you can open it. There is a compatibility issue sometimes between Mac and Windows. If you have a hassle, just call your financial advisor, and they should be able to open it for you and guide you through the process. But it's really there for you. Okay. But I just want to wrap up this discussion about moving financial planners. One of the things that one needs to look for today in a financial planner is a bit of pedigree. Has the person got a degree in finance, in economics, in financial planning? Do they have a higher diploma? Do they have an honors in financial planning? And those are the things that you need to look for. I'm not saying that every financial planner needs to be a CFP, because every financial planner today, if they're still carrying a license, has constantly upskilled and learned the latest products, because it's an ongoing requirement, an ongoing what we call CPD requirement. But there are many, many youngsters coming into the industry today who have got incredible academic background, incredible experience in different areas of finance and investments, and are now starting their own financial planning practices by either joining a bigger company or starting on their own. And those are people to really look at. I look at youngsters coming into the industry today, and I'm talking about people in their late 20s, and they are dynamic. They've got the academia, they have got the energy, they've got the experience, and they're not fazed by things that would put a 40 or 50-year-old into a total spin, to work a rewards program, to use software, to use AI. This is just part of who they are. This is how they roll. And you, as a client, will get the advantage of all that fresh input coming into it. So, age and experience does count, but so does energy and a sense of urgency from a younger person also counts. So take that into consideration. And I would just like to finish off by simply saying that when you start fresh, you start with a new person, always bear one thing in mind. And this I've said consistently for the last decade or two. Financial planning is 80% common sense. We add, which is a mixture of experience and academia. If someone is talking nonsense to you, then you need to say, this doesn't make sense. I'm not comfortable with it. It's too good to be true, and I am going to walk away. So those are the things that you really need to take to heart. Just to end off this particular subject, I remember I had a person who came into my office that he had sued a particular financial planner at a bank because they had given him a return on his investment based on past returns, but they had he had guaranteed it. He had put the word, "I guarantee that you'll get at least X percent return." And one should never do that because we cannot guarantee anything unless we give a guaranteed product where it's spelt out in black and white what it's going to be. So get the information, sit with something that you're comfortable with, and make sure that you've got everything in place. The next question that I got was very, very interesting. And I got it from one or two people in different ways. They both were young. And it was interesting to see that it came, to put it bluntly, across the sector of South African society. It came from maybe people who are more affluent and for people who are less affluent. And I'm judging it purely on the area that they said they grew up or the jobs that they are doing. But the rule still applies. And the question is, how much should I save from the day I start working? Now, I can see faces smiling, I can see faces frowning, and I can hear dissenting views coming from all over. It all depends on the individual. That's the starting point. We need to look at the individual's need. If you've got a youngster who's put him or herself through university and battled, it's paying back loans, it's now got a good job, but feels a huge amount of emotional and moral responsibility to look after people at home, and every penny is spent carefully, every coin is turned over three times. To tell them to put away 20% of the income means someone goes hungry. It's a very challenging thing. On the other hand, when you talk to another person, they might say 20%, but I was thinking more 50, because I don't pay rent, I stay at home. My dad pays my car insurance. I pay my own fuel, but sometimes I take his petrol card, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, you realize that you've got a dichotomy here. You've got what we call in economics a Gini coefficient that is just massive between the haves and the have-nots. So let's pull the two together. Let's find a middle ground and let's talk generally about the theory. And then your financial planner would have to adapt it to each person. So what we like to talk about is the 50-30-20 rule. I'm sure a lot of you have heard it. It's universal, but it applies. That 50% of your income should go for your needs. And by the way, here we're talking about net income after you've paid tax and after you've had deductions for pension or provident fund. 30% goes for wants. In other words, your entertainment, your dining out, travels, hobbies, whatever else you have. And 20% goes for savings. Now we can further break those categories down, but that is the rule of thumb. 50, 30, 20. 50% you have to spend just to get through the month. 30% is, going out, making sure that you have a bit of downtime. I don't know, taking your mountain bike out, paying entrance fee to a park, going out for a movie, if youngsters still do that, I don't know, et cetera, et cetera. Those are imperative activities to keep you young and fresh and agile. And then the 20% goes into savings. What they also talk about is building an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months' worth of expenses. It is almost impossible for someone to do that if they are spending a good 80% of the income. How do you save that? Let's break it down into simple maths. If you're earning 10,000 rand a month, 50%, 5 grand you need to spend. 3,000 rand is what keeps the wheels going and the joy of life. You've got 2,000 rand left for savings. How many months is this going to take you to save 10,000 rand? It's going to take you 5 months. Now you need to build up 3 to 6 times of that. It's a bit of a headache. But for those of you who can remember back to Corona, all of a sudden, people lost their jobs and they had zero prospect of getting a new job for the foreseeable future. And that's where those funds come into place. So if you're young and if you're starting out, it's as Robert Kiyosaki always talks about, delayed gratification. It's maybe about taking that 30% and saying, do I have three or four clean shirts? Do I have two interchangeable ties, if that's what you need to use? Am I able to change on a daily basis and make sure that I look fresh and presentable every day at work without feeling that I'm compromised in my appearance, at the same time not going overboard? And that's really what it means in the beginning. It's about getting used to this concept of you need to put money away and you need to save it. Of that 20%, one needs to look at retirement savings and one needs to look at savings for an event. So retirement savings are 26.5% of your gross income. So let's say your gross income is 10, that's 2,600 rand that you could put away in a retirement vehicle that would be tax deductible. In other words, you wouldn't be taxed on 10,000, you'll be taxed on 10,000 minus 2,600 on the 7,400. That's what you would be taxed on. So it lowers your tax threshold. However, that money is untouchable until you retire. So many young people need to save towards a property. Properties are expensive. 100% bonds are hard to come by. You need to have a kitty. So it's this juggle between putting away for retirement and putting away for something else. And again, if you sit with your financial planner and you look at it, maybe buying a house could be the best financial investment that you make. It hasn't been great over the last while, but owning your own home in an area that's growing, in an area that you want to bring your children up, in an area that has the schools and the social and the community environment that you're looking for, might give you a good capital growth going forward because of the demand. And maybe saving for that would be as good an idea as putting into a retirement plan where you get the tax deduction. The other thing that is something that one can look at is the interest rates movements. The interest rates just came down now, and all of a sudden, you can do one of two things and say, sure, my bond repayments have gone from X to X minus, and I've got a little bit of spare cash now to use in that 30% discretion if you what I want. Or you could do the prudent thing, as we discussed 2 weeks ago, call the bank and say, no, I want to keep my repayments as they were. I don't want to pay a lesser amount because the interest rates have dropped. And all of a sudden, you will now have be putting the same amount of money into your bond as you were before, but you'll be depleting your capital at a quicker rate. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
This is RV on Business.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. And just to round off, we are talking about savings from your first paycheck. And one of the old adages that go around is that your expenses rise to meet your income. Take a moment for that to settle in, because what are we talking about? How do your expenses rise to meet your income? It's because of our nature as human beings. The more we earn, the more we feel we can earn, we can live better, we can afford things that we couldn't afford before. And sometimes those things aren't necessarily important. And all of a sudden, where you were getting by with a lesser salary, you're not really getting by with a greater salary. So it's important to make sure that your expenses don't rise to meet your income. But as you earn more and your earning potential increases, so your savings part increases even more. And those are the things that are really, really important. But your long-term goal is to save between 15 and 25% of your income for wealth building. Wealth building, what is wealth? Wealth is your assets minus your liabilities equals wealth. So if you think of it simply on a property, it's your home that has a market value of 2 million minus what you owe the bank, 1.9 million, your wealth is 100,000 rand. Even though you drive into a beautiful home every day, your wealth is almost zero. So your goal is to make sure that the liabilities get reduced, the assets continue to grow, so that the difference between the two is always there, and therefore your wealth is increasing. As one gets more familiar with it, as one becomes more comfortable with it, increasing your liabilities at time in order to gain new assets is the way that people grow wealth, but it's a process and it takes time and it's methodical. But great, thank you so much for those questions. It was really nice just to get into the meat of it and to discuss questions that I know are close to everybody's heart. We are unfortunately out of time. Craig, thank you so much for pushing the buttons. Everybody, thank you for listening. We will chat to you next week.